Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Supporting Effective Child Welfare Supervision No. 1A Framework Conference Call. At this time, all participant lines are in a listen-only mode. Later, we'll conduct question-and-answer sessions, and instructions will be given at those times. If anyone should require operator assistance, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded. I would now like to turn the conference over to your host, Ms. Susan Kinnick. Ma'am, you may begin.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon and welcome, everyone. I'm Susan Kinnack, representing the National Child Welfare Resource Center for Organizational Improvement. This teleconference is co-sponsored by the National Resource Centers for Family-Centered Practice and Permanency Planning and Organizational Improvement. Both NRCs are part of a network of organizations funded by the Department of Health and Human Services Children's Bureau to provide technical assistance to child welfare agencies and tribes across the country. Today's teleconference is the first of a two-part series focusing on supervision in child welfare. This is a timely topic. As we all know, child welfare supervisors influence virtually all aspects of child welfare and have an essential role in helping achieve desired organizational and child, youth, and family outcomes. One impetus for this call is a recent publication developed by the National Resource Center for Family-Centered Practice and Permanency Planning and the National Child Welfare Resource Center for Organizational Improvement entitled Building a Framework and Model for Child Welfare Supervision. This is a publication that you're going to hear more about throughout this call. Presenters will introduce some of the key concepts in the publication and will build on various aspects of this document. We do have more than 300 individuals and agencies registered for this call, so we can't do a roll call today, but just to let you know, on the line we have representatives from state, county, and tribal child welfare agencies, ACF regional offices, colleges and universities, provider agencies, individual consultants, legal services organizations, court improvement projects, and members of the Training and Technical Assistance Network. We have a nice mix of folks on the line. I welcome each of you and am glad that you took the time from your busy schedules to join us in this important conversation. A minute on logistics. I want to remind you that the lines will be kept on mute during the presentations. After each presenter, and there will be four, the operator will open the line for a brief Q&A session, and we hope to have additional time at the end of the call for more discussion. You can find the handouts for this call on the NRCOI's teleconference page, which is at www.nrcoi.org. Once you get there, just click on teleconferences and scroll down until you find today's call. That's where you're going to find the publication we'll be referring to, Building a Framework and Model for Child Welfare Supervision. Finally, this call is being taped and will be available for downloading within a day or two on the NRCOI website. Okay, let me now introduce our presenters for today's call. First is Peg Hess. Peg is a consultant on child welfare practice and policy and currently is a senior consultant with the National Resource Center for Family-Centered Practice and Permanency Planning. Peg was formerly a professor at the University of South Carolina College of Social Work and the Columbia University School of Social Work. She co-edited the recent text, Child Welfare for the 21st Century, a Handbook of Practices, Policies, and Programs. Joining Peg on the call is Crystal Collins. Crystal is an assistant professor at the Kent School of Social Work at the University of Louisville. She is the former director of the Southern Regional Quality Improvement Center on Child Protection, which conducted a multi-state study on the impact of clinical casework supervision on frontline child welfare. She is a former child welfare worker, supervisor, and statewide specialist. And finally on the call will be Julie Atkins. Julie is a research associate at the Cutler Institute for Child and Family Policy here at the Muskie School. Her work focuses primarily on intersecting systems and their effect on families, such as child welfare, child care, legal criminal justice, early intervention, and TANF. She is currently working on the Colorado 4E Child Welfare Training Project and recently completed Children at Risk in the Child Welfare System, Collaborations to Promote School Readiness. So thank you so much to Peg, Crystal, and Julie for your willingness to join our call and share your information and wisdom with us. Here's how the call will flow today. Peg will start us off by discussing a bit about our publication and then talk about the elements of an emerging supervision model for child welfare. Then I'm going to talk a bit about a roadmap that will help agency leaders design an organization that promotes effective supervision. Crystal will then offer some examples of her work with child welfare agencies around clinical casework supervision. And we'll wrap up with Julie introducing a resource list of publications and materials that you may find useful to know about as you think about ways to build and sustain effective child welfare supervision. So with that as our introductory remarks, let me turn the call over to my colleague, Peg. Peg Hess?
Thank you, Susan. We're very excited to be talking with you all today about work that has been ongoing for probably almost 2 years, and that has been really rewarding to us in terms of what we've been able to learn and the colleagues we've been able to talk with. So we're excited to share some of that work with you today. As Susan mentioned, the handouts are on the Resource Center webpage, and there will be several that I will be referring to. So if you haven't brought that up on your computer and can, you may want to go ahead and do that. As Susan indicated, professionals and the literature in child welfare agree that the supervisory role is central to achieving service outcomes, including children's safety, well-being and permanence, and family preservation when possible, and to achieving organizational outcomes, such as high morale. There's a growing recognition that supervisors are pivotal to retaining frontline staff, evaluating progress toward desired practice outcomes, and to identifying the need for practice and organizational change. Because supervisors interact with a broad range of constituencies, both within the community as well as others within the agency, they are in a position to interpret the organization's mission, vision, values, practice philosophy, and model. The need for this project was identified following the first round of the Child and Family Services reviews. This project was funded by the Children's Bureau to provide a roadmap for agency leaders to guide them in developing and implementing strategies that support effective child welfare supervision. So what I'm saying is that this monograph is intended to be a call to action. In order to provide the envisioned roadmap for assessment, planning, and action, we identified two questions that required in-depth review and study. First, is there a current model for child welfare supervision, and if so, what elements does it include? And second, what is required of organizational leaders and other organizational staff to develop, support, and maintain effective child welfare supervision? To address these two broad questions, we used a methodology that involved a number of steps. The methodology is described in detail on pages 45 through 47 of the monograph, and I will just highlight those steps briefly. First, from around the country, we invited current child welfare administrators, regional and area managers, supervisors, practitioners, state foster care managers, Children's Bureau staff, recruitment and retention grantees, educators, and the Southern Regional Quality Improvement Center to serve as a working group. This working group was extremely important in advising us at every step of our work. Second, we conducted an in-depth review of literature concerning supervision in child welfare, social work, psychology, and counseling. And then we further expanded that using recommendations from our working group. Third, we developed an interview guide, which we'll refer to as the protocol, to interview current agency managers, supervisors, and frontline practitioners. We asked them all about several things. First, the job responsibilities of child welfare supervisors and the relative importance of each of these responsibilities, the needs of supervisors from their varying perspectives, and both the obstacles that undermine effective child welfare supervision and the organizational supports necessary to achieve it. At this point, I'd like for you to take a look at Table 1. It's entitled Job Responsibilities Ranked Most Important by Kadushin Categories. And there we're referring to Alfred Kadushin, whose framework for supervision in social work included the administrative, educational, and supportive functions. When you look at this handout, you will see an abbreviated version of the job responsibility items that we developed in consultation with the literature and the working group for the interview guide. As you can see, these are grouped by Kadushin's categories, administrative, educational, and supportive supervision. This table presents the percentage of key informants that rated each job responsibility as either most important or important. What I wanted to highlight here is that you can see that 95% or more of the key informants rated 26 of the 30 items, one of these items was added during data analysis, as either most important or important. So periodically, when I refer to the emerging consensus in the field and the literature about supervisory job responsibilities, this is part of what I'm referring to. We thought that was a really striking consensus among the various respondents. They also declined, all of them, to add additional job responsibilities. They felt that this list was inclusive. If you look for a minute at Table 2, you will see the same list. And what we have done there is to revise this one component of the protocol so that it could be used within an agency to collect information about staff's own perceptions about these job responsibilities, which are most important, important, not important, even not applicable, and also to having discussions about what are the obstacles to achieving this responsibility or supports to achieving this responsibility. This table is page 26 in the monograph that is available at the website. So I'll step back now for a moment to the methodology. By telephone, using the protocol, we interviewed key informants who were recommended by the working group in three job positions, administrators, supervisors, and practitioners. We also interviewed experts currently involved in system-wide efforts to improve child welfare supervision, not using the protocol, but inquiring about our preliminary findings and discussing the same categories of content. And we surveyed the members of the peer training network about current curricula used for pre-service and in-service training of supervisors. We then analyzed the information gained from all of these sources, the literature review, the in-depth interviews with key informants, the survey, and developed a preliminary report of findings to review with the working group, who gave us many suggestions and strengthened the products that we were able to develop. As I've indicated, we found a consensus about an emerging model of child welfare supervision and its elements. We also found consensus about the organizational supports needed to promote effective child welfare supervision, and Susan will be talking about that in a few minutes. But first, let's take some time to look at the emerging model of child welfare supervision and its elements. I think the easiest way for you to follow with me, perhaps, is to look at the table of contents, which is another handout. Under Section 1, you'll see the elements that I'll be discussing, and under Section 2, you'll see the elements that Susan will be highlighting. You'll see that under Section 1, there are seven elements of an emerging model for child welfare supervision. Identification of a model for supervision has a number of advantages. For example, a model provides knowledge, a sense of security. It establishes a reliable framework. It provides important initial direction for new supervisors. It assists in managing difficult challenges, confusion, and it provides common expectations and a language for professionals in the field. Let me briefly highlight each of these elements. The first element, articulate in writing the organization's practice philosophy and approach. As you're all aware, supervision in child welfare occurs in a very distinctive context, and that context includes an agency's philosophy and preferred practice approaches. Therefore, a model of supervision necessarily identifies an organization's philosophy and practice approaches. Bordeaux has defined a practice model as a clear written explanation of how the agency successfully functions. For example, according to the Children's Bureau and principles and findings from the Child and Family Services reviews, child welfare practice should be child-focused, family-centered, individualized, collaborative, enhanced to strengthen parental capacity, community-based, culturally responsive, and outcome-oriented. Any agency's child welfare practice, philosophy, and approach would most likely include all of these elements. The second element of a child welfare supervision model is to identify the functions and specific job responsibilities of child welfare supervisors. And you may recall that those responsibilities, as we gathered information about them in the protocol, are listed in both tables 1 and 2. The discussion of these responsibilities is the most extensive section in the monograph, pages 10 through 18. The monograph lists all of the child welfare job supervisor responsibilities highlighted in these tables, provides a definition and description, examples of each of them, and also highlights the meaning of them through excerpts from our interviews with key informants. I want to reiterate the consensus we found in the literature and interviews about these responsibilities. Although we found similarities and differences in supervisors, practitioners, and administrators' perspectives regarding the relative importance of these job responsibilities, as you noted on Table 1, 100% agreed that 15 of the 31 were either important or most important, and 95% 26 of them agreed were, well, I'm really making a mess of this sentence, aren't I? 95% of them agreed that 26 of the items were either important or most important, a very striking consensus. I also want to emphasize that each of these responsibilities, although grouped by Gadushin's framework of administrative, educational, and supportive, are overlapping and complementary. Many fulfill all three functions. For example, a peer group case review most likely is educational for the workers and perhaps the supervisors involved as well, is supportive, provides emotional support, and may also fulfill some administrative functions for those who are attending. Element 3, recognize the centrality of building and maintaining relationships with supervisees and others to carrying out supervisory responsibilities effectively. As you all know, developing professional relationships requires time, commitment, interpersonal skill, and understanding of the multiple complicated factors that affect these relationships, such as authority, personal needs, organizational culture. But without these relationships, both internal and external to the organization, a supervisor cannot fulfill his or her role effectively. Element four is one that I read with over 30 years of child welfare experience, and I, as I'm sure for many of you, have had some strong feelings about, and that element is mandate explicit, manageable standards for caseload size and for supervisor-supervisee ratios. Since the beginning of my professional career in child welfare more than 30 years ago, I, along with probably many of you, have observed and participated in our struggle to assure that practitioners and supervisors have manageable workloads. Unfortunately, high caseloads and high supervisor-supervisee ratios continue to undermine effective child welfare supervision in many agencies. Both the Child Welfare League of America and the Council on Accreditation provide guidelines and standards for these. The fifth element is defining expectations with regard to the frequency and format for supervision of frontline practitioners. I think we all recognize the benefits for both practitioners and supervisors of individual one-to-one planned and regular meetings for supervision, as well as the benefits of peer group supervision. There is an emerging consensus in the field that both regularly scheduled individual and group supervision or case review should be incorporated in the model of child welfare supervision. The sixth element is clarifying expectations for ongoing evaluation of frontline practitioners. Some may ask, what does evaluation of workers have to do with a model for effective child welfare supervision? Evaluation, when handled well and consistently throughout the organization, shapes caseworkers' job performance, promotes their ongoing professional development, addresses performance problems, and provides information about how well things are working within the organization and within the community. Supervisors must be provided with the process and the authority to address supervisees' performance difficulties. Otherwise, they do not have the means to impact the quality of client services. The seventh element, support supervisors in their roles as unit leaders and change agents. Although this is the last element of the emerging model identified in this monograph, it definitely is not the least. As one of the administrators we interviewed stated, supervisors have their thumbs on the pulse of practice. Supervisors have to take a leadership role. They have a key role in shaping and developing policies and practices. We are talking here about empowerment. Empowerment to carry out a wide range of responsibilities, including providing leadership to supervisors' units and within the agency and community, and including proposing and advocating for relevant changes. This section of the monograph provides a great deal more information about each of these elements that gives you a sense of what's contained in Section 1. Are there a couple of burning or quick questions before we move on to Susan's discussion of Section 2?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, you may press the 1 key on your touch-tone telephone. If the question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Our first question or comment is from Megan Seaman. Go ahead, please.
No, I'm sorry. I didn't push anything.
Thank you. Again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question, please press the 1 key at this time. I'm showing no questions in queue at this time, ma'am. You may proceed.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Peg. That was a great introduction to our topic today. I'm now going to talk about a roadmap that will help agency leaders think through and create an organization that promotes effective supervision. Child welfare leaders across the country are looking for proven strategies and tools that build an organization that helps supervisors be effective in their work. Designing and delivering this organizational support is a leadership activity, one that can be supported by other internal units such as training, human resources, and information technology, but it is an activity that must be led by top administrators. To empower child welfare supervisors to effectively carry out their administrative, educational, and supportive functions, leadership needs to create and sustain an organization that has four key components. These components are, one, an organizational culture that values and demonstrates support for the vital role supervisors play in ensuring positive outcomes for children, youth, and families. So the first one is a positive organizational culture. The second component is a model of supervisory practice that reflects how the organization views the roles, responsibilities, and expectations of supervisors, and also includes accurate, up-to-date, written job descriptions. The third component is systematic recruitment and retention of individuals who are a quote-unquote good fit as frontline practitioners and supervisors. And the fourth component is a continuum of professional development opportunities for new and experienced supervisors that includes initial and ongoing training, peer support, mentors, and clinical consultation. Striving to get these components in place and working cohesively is a major ongoing leadership challenge. In the next few minutes, I'm going to highlight a few key strategies and tools in each of these components that are a roadmap for agency leadership. Full details of other ideas, tools, and strategies can be found in Section 2 in the Building a Framework and Model for Child Welfare Supervision publication. Okay, let's start with Component 1. That is creating an organizational culture that values and demonstrates support for the vital role supervisors play in ensuring positive outcomes for children, youth, and families. To build a culture that effectively supports supervisory practice, the organization must first understand how it currently views the child welfare supervisor's role, functions, responsibilities, and expectations. The agency should identify how the existing operational definition of supervision supports current and projected needs of frontline practitioners, families served by the organization, supervisory staff, and organizational leaders and managers. Information also should be sought concerning resources, such as technology, including MIS, SACWIS data, and funding, that could support supervisors in carrying out their responsibilities. Completing an assessment that recognizes how the agency currently views the supervisory role will identify activities and resources that facilitate, as well as obstacles that undermine, supervisors' success. That information can be used as the foundation upon which plans for change can be built. The use of a brief survey instrument helps focus the collection and analysis of information and ensures that relevant areas are examined in the assessment. This assessment should include input from the supervisors themselves, as well as other individuals at all levels of the organization and key stakeholders. Our publication provides a tool that might be helpful as part of that assessment. So when thinking about how to support effective supervision in child welfare, a first priority for leadership is creating and sustaining an organizational culture that values and demonstrates support for the role supervisors play. Let's look at another component that needs to be in place to support effective supervision. That is building a model of supervisory practice that reflects how the organization views the roles, responsibilities, and expectations of supervisors. Peg has already talked about an emerging model of supervision in child welfare, so I'm going to focus on the need for up-to-date written job descriptions. Some of the ongoing stress in being a supervisor results from lack of clear definition of the supervisor's tasks, responsibility, and authority. This stress could be reduced by agencies if they clearly stated what is expected of the supervisors and have in place a specific written description of the supervisor's responsibilities. Both the expectation and job description should focus equally on the three main supervisory functions defined by Kadushin: administrative, educational, and supportive supervision. A written job description has multiple uses, including identifying the skill set and characteristics sought when recruiting and hiring and selecting supervisors in order to get the right people, developing a performance appraisal for child welfare supervisors, and also assisting supervisors in evaluating their own needs for training and professional development and identifying issues for their own supervision. As we were gathering the data that Peg referenced earlier on in this call, we asked everyone we spoke to if we could see a job description for supervisors. And it was really very interesting to us that we saw a couple. We had a couple submitted to us. But most of the supervisors told us that the job description they were working under was not really up to date, did not include all their functions, and was not relevant to the work they did on a day-to-day basis. So with that and the expectations ever shifting and changing, it was really hard for the supervisors to feel confident that they understood what was expected of them, and therefore to communicate some of that down to the staff. So while this seems like a small thing, it was really important in the minds of the supervisors we talked to. Let's look at another piece of the framework, a framework designed to support effective supervision, and that's recruitment and retention of individuals who are a good fit as frontline practitioners and supervisors. To me, one of the most powerful statements we heard when we interviewed workers was this one, and this is a direct quote from a caseworker. "The most serious obstacle to child welfare supervisors' effectiveness is staff turnover. The supervisors often have to pick up additional cases and job duties due to employees leaving. This doesn't give them ample time to focus on ongoing supervision, training, and employee retention." That's the end of the quote. It's very important for agency leadership to identify obstacles to the recruitment and retention of experienced and effective frontline practitioners and supervisors, and to develop and implement an organizational-wide short and long-term plan to address these obstacles. The development of such an organizational plan should draw upon the assessment of the organization's view of supervision that I mentioned earlier, as well as information collected through exit interviews, focus groups, et cetera, regarding the primary factors contributing to staff turnover. Thinking about recruitment, such organizational plans should identify and implement a variety of proven recruitment tools and strategies, such as realistic job previews and competency-based pre-screening tools, to assess suitability for the complex, emotionally demanding, yet rewarding work of child welfare. Thinking about retention, the organization should consider supports such as regular use of employee assistance programs to address issues related to stress and burnout, recruiting at least one as-needed supervisor and/or advanced practitioner position to cover caseloads when workers leave, and to assist supervisors when unanticipated crises or rotating supervisors from a high-stress supervisory situation to another assignment to reduce the development of burnout. These are some ideas that were suggested to us through our conversations and literature that could help keep your supervisors in place. A final and related component of an organization that supports effective supervision is ensuring that a continuum of professional development opportunities for new and experienced supervisors that includes initial and ongoing training, peer support, mentors, and clinical consultation exists. That continuum will be most effective if the training design and content balances knowledge and skills in the administrative, educational, and supportive aspects of supervision, and includes instruction and practice in sharing and applying the learning with supervisors, team, and units. One of the things that we heard throughout our interviews is that so much of the training supervisors receive focuses on the administrative pieces of their job and not so much on the educational and supportive pieces. We also heard that the training they receive, if it's on an advanced content area, is strictly on that content but does not include information or practice or advice for how the supervisor can take that information back to their unit and apply it. And the supervisors felt that that was something that would be extraordinarily helpful for them. Administrators and managers must communicate the importance of ongoing educational support for supervision and consistently expect and protect supervisors' participation. That's another thing that supervisors told us. It's very hard for them to get away to participate in training, and that is not the most positive model for them to be setting for their workers. That could, again, be another use for one of those as-needed supervisors to cover while the supervisors are at training. I've quickly walked through the highlights of an integrated organizational framework that agency leadership can use as a roadmap as they think through providing effective child welfare supervision in their agencies. The framework we've been talking about addresses perceived obstacles to effective child welfare supervision that have been identified by child welfare supervisors, administrators, and workers. This framework also takes into account the essential functions and job responsibilities of child welfare supervisors and incorporates key current supervisory principles. Putting in place an organization that includes these four components should strengthen the link between supervisor effectiveness, worker practice, and client outcomes. Are there any quick questions now before I turn this over to Crystal?
Thank you. Again, ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press the 1 key on your touch-tone telephone. I'm showing no audio questions, ma'am. You may proceed.
Okay. Thank you. Crystal, can I turn the call over to you?
Absolutely. Good afternoon, everyone. As Susan mentioned earlier, I am with the University of Louisville, and I formerly had the opportunity to work with a number of states on trying to reform the frontline supervision practice, moving to a more clinical case consultation approach, supportive and educational aspects that we've heard both Peg and Susan talk about. And we conducted a four-state study that involved Missouri, Mississippi, Arkansas, and Tennessee at the time to see what the impact of refocusing supervision in that way might be on practice outcomes, client outcomes, retention, et cetera. To talk about that particular study and our findings is really beyond the scope of what we're going to talk about today, but all that information can be found on the website, which is listed with the handouts for this teleconference. I do want to highlight, though, some of the examples both from those states and also from other states that we've had the opportunity to work with subsequently that really reinforce the aspects of the framework that you've heard about. I think the development of the framework is really timely in that it's clear to us that so many states have been looking to hone supervisory practice change to address a number of issues. And I think that there's a recognition that we've often overburdened our supervisors with administrative tasks, making it difficult for them to focus on those aspects of their work that have direct impact on the services that are being provided to children and families. And that was really clear to us near the end of our work with the Southern Regional Quality Improvement Center in late 2005 when we hosted a supervisory summit in Memphis, Tennessee that was attended by 36 states, Canada, Puerto Rico, and the District of Columbia, involved a number of facilitated roundtable discussions that had to do with what the challenges were in child welfare supervision. And it was clear to us that some of these same themes that have played out in the framework were being seen even 4 years ago by states. The need to emphasize efforts to improve organizational culture, the key role supervision plays in promoting practice change and in interpreting the various changes states were doing, and the need for states to really turn their attention to this somewhat neglected portion of the workforce, both in terms of training, because many states that they said that they had no standardized training for supervisors, or if they did, it was more in the area of administrative tasks, or the issue of clearly defining the role of the supervisor and how that fit with the practice model. When you look at the program improvement plans that a number of states have developed as a result of the CFSR, there seem to be two kind of approaches that states are taking, and of course there's many variations within that, to enhance supervision in their state as a way of improving overall outcomes and performance. And one of the approaches tends to be focused on compliance and oversight, and the other focus seems to be centering around supportive and clinical approaches, the educational aspects of supervision, and many of the things that are outlined in the framework. One of the things that a number of states have worked to achieve is the development of the ability for state supervisors to be involved in some sort of peer networking and consultation or support in order to reinforce the supervisory activities, help them problem solve with each other, help them share with each other the challenges and strategies that they are using to promote that organizational culture, to select the right staff, to deal with challenges in performing performance evaluation and promoting positive practice in the front line. An example of that has been work that's been done in the state of Mississippi and subsequently in Upper California, Nevada, and also in Missouri to develop opportunities for supervisors on a regional basis to get together and do that kind of learning and problem-solving work together. The other thing that I think has been emphasized by the framework is the importance of professional development of supervisors. I've already mentioned that so many states have not had the level of training or ongoing professional development that they'd like to have for supervisors, and I really think that that's a critical aspect of the work, and I think the idea of it being ongoing professional development is very much an important piece. The state of Missouri has chosen to take a very comprehensive approach to doing that kind of work. In addition to having statewide training on the clinical aspects of supervision, they've built in three additional initiatives that are being rolled out currently that are designed to really focus that professional development culture for supervisors to take advantage of. One of those is using a 360-degree evaluation approach so that supervisors have the opportunity to have feedback from staff they supervise, those above them, and their colleagues in order to develop a learning plan where they can really move forward on their own professional goals, honing their own supervision techniques, et cetera. And they have also taken the opportunity to plan for learning laboratories that will be taking place on a regional basis in multiple locations around the state so that supervisors in counties near each other will have a quarterly opportunity to come together and provide that peer consultation and support. you know, one of the things that we heard, we've heard so much from around the country is that particularly in rural areas, child welfare supervisors are very isolated. They don't necessarily have peers within the agency in their own county. So it's important to allow those opportunities for states to interact with each other. Another example that I thought was very important about what you've heard and what you'll read if you look into the very rich detail in the framework that's been developed is how supervisors can have the role of promoting evidence-informed practice on the front line. And in order to do that, they need to have data that is drilled down to their own organizational unit in a usable form so that they can really have an outcomes-focused approach and really look at how practice is or is not achieving the outcomes that they want. And a number of states like Illinois, Florida, and also we have a new pilot that's beginning in Kentucky, will be really focusing on trying to arm supervisors and workers with that kind of information to promote that ongoing evidence-informed practice. And finally, the other piece that I wanted to mention is initiatives that states can undertake that really help development of that supervisory-worker relationship. It's clear from the data that was collected for the development of the framework as well as the work that we've done and elsewhere that really supervisory practice happens in that interactional relationship between the worker and the supervisor. So how can we set up the opportunity for that to happen in a proactive way and less on the crisis-driven sort of supervision that often can happen in child welfare because of the kind of work that we do. And there are a few states, such as Arkansas and parts of Florida, that have tried to build in a regular case review, supervisory review process in which the supervisor on a regular basis sits down with each worker and reviews all of their cases from a clinical standpoint as opposed to an administrative or compliance standpoint to really help the worker figure out how to proceed with the case, how to reflect back on whether or not progress is being made, how to vary their practice with families in order to receive the outcomes that they're looking for. And I think that there are a number of things that states can do to put tools in the hands of the supervisors to enable them to do that in a structured way and make that supervisory review process meaningful as opposed to just kind of sitting down and covering what often becomes, you know, just a very crisis-driven or administrative-driven process. I think that the final piece that I wanted to mention is the organizational culture piece, because no matter what happens in the administrative level of the agency, and if the agency is attempting to, you know, promote an organizational culture that is focused on learning and evidence-informed practice and outcomes for families, that really happens in that organizational unit. And I think that that comes through very clearly in the framework that Susan and Peg have developed in collaboration with others. And I think that it's very important for supervisors to learn about how organizational culture and climate are created and nourished and facilitated on the front line, especially when caseloads are so high, as many states are experiencing. There's a lot of budget-related restrictions. It's a very crisis-ridden type of work. The kind of challenges that families are involved in bringing to the agency are ones that you know, the culture can easily be following a path that does not promote that kind of ongoing learning. And so I think a number of the initiatives that we've already talked about, Missouri, Mississippi, Arkansas, a number of areas are really looking at how can we help supervisors have the tools to interpret that organizational culture and build a positive climate. And I guess the final plug, as a researcher who is very interested in supporting child welfare practice, is the critical role of measuring whatever your state is choosing to undergo related to supervision so that it's very clear whether or not you're receiving the outcomes for your whatever supervisory program, whether it's training or peer support or supporting supervisors in other ways, whether or not it's having the impact that you want. And I think that the tool that Peg described that's in the framework would be very helpful for states to be able to sort of step back and assess where are they in terms of what's being provided for supervisors and how can they what are the areas where the state can best invest its resources in this way? So I'll stop at this point, and I've just listed things very quickly. We'll stop and see if anyone has any questions before we move on to Julie.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press the 1 key on your touch tone telephone. I'm showing no questions at this time, ma'am.
Okay, then I will turn it over to Julie, who will talk about the literature.
Great. Hi, everybody. We just wanted to take a few minutes to walk you through this literature review resource, and it's available both as an appendix within the full report and also as a standalone handout on the teleconference website. And our intent was to pull together organizational and practice-based supports for supervisors and to include practical examples whenever possible. And these are taken from the child welfare literature whenever we could, but also from social work and business literature. The supports are grouped into categories including training, administrative and fiscal, recruitment and retention, facilitating communication, enhancing caseworker performance, anticipating and managing risk, ethics and supervision, and selecting a model of supervision. And some of these are brief suggestions pulled from the literature, and others are examples that are complete with contact information wherever we were able to get that. For example, on page 50, which is the first section under training, we actually have a sample of information on the learning laboratory that Crystal was referencing, and it has some contact information if that was a model that you were interested in looking further into for your state. And we have used this list to compile the list of supervisor job responsibilities that Peg was referencing, but we hope that it'll also provide some concrete examples for you. I can take questions if anybody has some on the lit review.
Thank you. Again, ladies and gentlemen, to ask a question, please press the 1 key at this time. I'm showing no questions at this time.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you, Julie, Peg, Crystal. This is Susan back again. And we can open it up to general questions or discussion about supervision. I would like to offer participants the opportunity to ask questions of our presenters or comment on something that they've been doing in their organization that they believe has been particularly effective in supporting that link between supervision, casework practice, and outcomes. So I will open up the lines. I did get some questions from people who could not be on the call today, and we'll be happy to ask those, but would first like to give the call participants a chance to ask questions or make their comments.
Thank you. Again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question or comment, please press the 1 key on your touch-tone telephone.
This is Peg. I was wondering, Crystal, if you could say a little bit more about the learning laboratories, actually describe them so people could have a sense of what that is, because I don't think it's been described very well in the literature yet.
Okay, sure. I'd be happy to. The idea is to bring supervisors together
in a forum that is really theirs to use in the way that they see fit, but having an external facilitator to help that process move along. So if you bring supervisors together, perhaps on a quarterly basis, they begin to build a relationship. They're always there with the same group, so that those relationships that may be at the beginning relatively, acquaintance style, or people may have had interactions on, you know, making referrals to each other or, you know, looking for a foster home or whatever. But after a short period of time, the facilitator will help the group decide how to spend the time. If they want to spend some time working with each other or learning new ways to promote a positive organizational culture, or how to use the standardized data reports that the state is producing in such a way that it connects to practice, the supervisors would, you know, set those topics out, and then the facilitator would work with them really just to keep the process moving so that the supervisors can work together, support each other, problem solve, but also participate in ongoing learning. And when this has taken place in the past, and particularly this was tested in our Mississippi project, what we found was that this particular opportunity for peer consultation and support grew to a high level of importance to the supervisors that had participated in it. It's easy for supervisors to think, oh, I don't want to go to another meeting because we have to go to so many meetings and I don't have time for one. But what we found was, and we've seen this in other areas as well, that once those peer relationships start building, the value of spending that time together, even if it's only once a quarter, becomes very important. And then the supervisors are able to be a support to them even outside the meetings because they've built those relationships. And also what we've heard is that this is a place where supervisors can become accountable to each other. And so if through the discussion, for example, about how to deal with a particularly challenging issue with a worker, perhaps you have a worker that seems to be doing good work with clients, but they do not do their paperwork on time, and so it's hard to know, you know, what's really happening with families and documenting. If the supervisors come up with some strategies that supervisor is going to use, then next time they meet, they check back in to see, you know, what's really happening. How did that work out for you? So it's an opportunity to build these ongoing relationships. And I'd be happy to answer any other questions about how people see that, or if anyone has examples of how you're using those kind of learning circles or peer networks in your state.
Thank you. I'm showing we do have a question from Marion Kelly. Go ahead, please.
And my question is about did you at all in your examination get into the qualifications for people to be supervisors, and it's in the various states that you worked with?
Peg, do you want to start on that one? Because I know this is a topic that's near and dear to your heart, and I'll fill in if you miss anything.
Well, we got into it, I would say, superficially rather than in depth. We had several references and interviews, and I believe in one of the, I'm trying to remember the organization that had recommended that supervisors have a master's in social work or an advanced degree, but we did not systematically ask about that or address that, no.
Well, the job description that's in the monograph doesn't require a master's degree, and those are standards both for CWLA standards of excellence and the Council on Accreditation of Services to Children and Families.
Yes.
It was a little, you know, I was hoping that there would be a resource there that would allow states to kind of point out and say, you see, this is what's, and it almost looks like it's not recommended, and I didn't know if that was just intentional or an oversight.
Well,
Susan, that I don't think it was intentional or an oversight. I think it more reflects the reality of what we found when we talked with folks. And the reality that we heard portrayed to us is that in many situations and in most situations, the agencies would prefer to be hiring MSWs, but that just can't happen for several reasons. Some is availability. Some of the reasons included just the resources and just the demands and numbers. In many cases, the MSWs just are not available in sufficient numbers. And that was, I believe, and Peg and Julie can correct me if I overstep here, I believe most folks felt that ideally an MSW would be required, but that just was not going to happen. And for them, for all sorts of reasons they felt they could not overcome. And this is creating, of course, for the supervisors themselves and for those they supervise, some significant opportunities for on-the-job training. It's creating some additional demands on the training systems, because folks are entering this profession with a variety of backgrounds and in many cases being promoted to the position of supervisor with very short periods of service. Traditionally, you know, you became a supervisor after 5, 7, 10 years as a worker, but what we heard was that in some states that in some places we talked to, the supervisors have only a couple of years of field experience, and so that does place additional training burdens on the supervisors, the administrators, and the training system. Peg, Julie, Crystal, would you like to add anything to that?
I would just like to add the reference I was trying to recall is the American Public Human Services Association, which, as you know, collects information from the states about a range of requirements and characteristics. And in their report from 2004, which was the most recent one I could find, they indicated that the majority of states did not have a specific requirement, although often a preference was expressed for MSWs. And I think Susan summed it up very well. We found people struggling greatly with the amount of turnover and the lack of consistency of frontline practitioner degrees, and the amount of turnover meant that those folks were moving very quickly into supervisory positions, so that discussing the qualifications for recruiting supervisors was not something that most people were emphasizing in their discussions with us. I certainly would agree with you and with the standards of COA CWLA.
Well, and I think their standards are a master's degree, which is, and what you state is a minimum of a bachelor's degree. And, you know, I think it is very challenging. And, you know, it's challenging to have people with MSWs and without experience carrying an expectation of being promoted into or hired into a supervisory role very quickly, and that combination of education and experience seems quite critical. So thank you for taking my question.
I guess this is Peg again. I would also add that although we cited the standards of CWLA and COA with regard to caseload size and supervisory ratios, we specifically addressed that because I can't think of anyone that we interviewed who did not emphasize high caseloads and staff turnover, which they saw as related, and I think most of us do, as being a major obstacle to being an effective child welfare supervisor, that people were constantly training, retraining, covering cases and whatever. And so that one emerged not out of our interest, but out of the emphasis that was put on it in the literature and in the interviews that we did.
And this is Susan again, and I think your question has caused me to go back and look at the sample job description that's in the report. And I don't think it's clear now that I'm looking at it, and I think we should go in and add a sentence that makes it clear. This is a job description that was provided to us by one of the states that had people we interviewed, and it was, I think, the most comprehensive job description I don't think this was the most comprehensive job description we saw. And again, as I mentioned in my earlier remarks, I believe we only had a couple submitted to us. So this is not held out to be ideal or perfect or to set a standard, but just to let folks know that this is one job description from one state that it was up to date and timely and seemed to be working for that agency. But I think we should put some wording around that to help clarify that. So I thank you very much for asking your question.
Thank you. Our next question is from Eileen Lely. Go ahead, please.
Hi, thanks. We're using Charmaine's putting the pieces together for supervisory training here in Alaska. And one of the things I consistently hear from folks, aside from what you just said of high caseloads and all, is, you know, we're not supervised in the way that you're going over with us good ways to supervise our workers. What's out there in terms of getting this information to the supervisory level's managers?
Hi, Eileen. This is Susan. It's good to hear your voice.
Yes.
You know, that's a good question, and I think there is going to be an answer for that. The Children's Bureau has funded, and perhaps there is someone on the line from the workforce grant that would speak to this one. The Children's Bureau has funded a consortium of universities to focus on training for mid-level managers. And part of that training, I believe, will be the basic supervision of supervisors, you know. And my hope is that by coming in and doing that sort of management, how you manage from the middle and how you manage up and how you supervise down, we'll begin to address some of the concerns that you're raising, Eileen, that are extraordinarily valid. I do know that there was an initial mid-level training program that was run out of the University of Utah, and that was focused on leadership. But my understanding, and if I'm pleading with anybody from the workforce grant that's on the call to jump in and help, that the mid-level manager will not focus just on leadership, but will get into some of the more basic skills that will be very helpful.
Great. And just a plug for Charmaine's work, our supervisors are loving it, and it is international. I used the supportive piece when I was in Russia recently with helpline workers, and it translates well.
Thank you. I agree that it's a brilliant supervisory curriculum, and if anybody would like to see the generic version of the curriculum that Eileen's talking about, that is available on the Resource Center, the NRCOI's website. Again, that's www.nrcoi.org. If you look under publications, training material, you'll find a version of the putting the pieces together for supervision that Charmaine and others have worked to customize for a number of states across the country. And that curriculum is available without cost. And it's a really good model, a good place to begin for those of you who are looking to provide some training for your supervisors.
Thank you.
Are there additional questions?
Thank you. Our next question is from Kathy McIntosh. Go ahead, please.
Hi, and I think this is for Crystal, really. About the learning lab, the learning circle, has there been any practice at doing those in other than face-to-face models? I'm concerned in Kansas that we have supervisors who are going to have a very difficult time, even quarterly, getting together, and if there's some way we could help support them through some online means, some other format?
You know, this has been discussed in a number of different formats. In Arkansas, that had much less emphasis actually on the learning lab piece than it did one-to-one mentoring,
But for the time that they were bringing supervisors together, they were in a similar place where they were, you know, several hours from one end to a region to another to really bring people together. And they tried to do this using like an ITV format or a, you know, the technology, the name of the technology is, but kind of video conferencing format. And their level of technology available in the state at that time, it just wasn't working well enough for them, and the supervisors just decided at that point they would rather drive, you know, to be face-to-face. But I do think that there is a lot, there's a great need to look into how we can facilitate these sorts of things using technology. And with webcams and audio conferencing and the various different technologies that are available now to do web conferencing, I would really encourage states to explore, you know, using that as a way to see if this can develop these kind of relationships without having people come together. I know Susan mentioned the Workforce Institute a few minutes ago, and in addition to the middle manager training, there was also a requirement by the Children's Bureau for there to be online supervision training. And I happen to be on the advisory board for the development of that, which is in progress. But I believe that what they are planning is to try to have, there will be some online modules and exercises, and then some sort of system for trying to promote the development of learning circles within states or within localities. So what I would suggest is that you keep your eye on what's happening with the Workforce Institute to see if they come up with some ways to perhaps they may be able to facilitate the development of kind of how the technology to work can work to do that. You know, certainly it's not optimal, but it is the reality in a lot of our states where there's large distances between supervisors.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Our next question is from Charmaine Britton. Go ahead, please.
Hi, this is Charmaine Britton. I'm with the Butler Institute for Families and also part of the team that's part of the National Child Welfare Workforce Institute. And there's been a lot of people talking about the Workforce Institute, so I just wanted to give people some more information. We do have a Middle Manager Leadership Academy that will start in September, and we're going to be holding these throughout the country. If you are interested in being a part of this academy and also being a part of the Supervisory Academy, which will be an online training opportunity for supervisors, you can find more information on ncwwi.org. And Crystal mentioned the online supervisor program, and yes, we will be trying to connect people via the computers into an online peer network. And so there will be more development on that as time goes on. This project just started in October, but we are making headway, and we should have some things up and running by this fall for both the Supervisor Leadership Academy as well as the Middle Manager Academy. So again, that website is ncwwi.org, and I'm so glad to hear that people are using the Putting the Pieces Together supervisory curriculum. So thank you for that. That's it.
Thanks, Charmaine, for that feedback. That's really important information, and I appreciate having the website out there.
Thank you. Again, ladies and gentlemen, if there are any further questions, please press the 1 key at this time. I'm showing we have a question from Irvin Kimberly. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, hi. I wanted to ask about any further kind of information or in your research about that, the connection between the classroom training and then transfer of learning that the supervisor in New York City, it's called a frontline manager, needs to carry out, so that experience with how managers are learn about what is in the training, having the skills and to further implement what's in the training, to take those plans that are developed in the training and work with their supervisors. Any information or thoughts about that?
Crystal, I have something to offer on that, I believe. This is a very important issue that has fewer our projects. We were, although the middle managers and upper managers were aware of what we were doing on the front line and were supportive of it, they had not been directly involved in any way in the detail of what we were actually teaching and asking supervisors to do differently. And about a 1 year into the project, it became clear in all four of our states that inadvertently what was happening in the middle management level was certainly not in many ways supporting this kind of change in supervisory practice on the front line, and in some ways was counter to it, because a lot of things states were doing were focusing supervisory reporting in different ways, a lot of focus on you know, accountability or administrative things. And what we had to do was kind of step back and look at, was there a way to have an abbreviated version of what we were offering to our supervisors to our middle managers? And in our four projects, we did do that, so that the middle managers were aware and were engaged and saw the reason for transforming the way practice was happening, and also knew how they could support it in their day-to-day practice. Because, as I said, I don't think it was intentional at all that they were driving supervisors in the wrong way. They just were, it was kind of the doing things as they, you know, have always been done. So I, you know, part of what we learned is that there needed to be some degree of education, but also engagement of middle managers. The other thing that I would like to offer about that is I think that the involvement of middle managers in whatever you're doing in terms of professional development of supervisors is critical from an organizational culture standpoint. When I mentioned in Missouri the move to use 360-degree evaluation processes and make those available to supervisors for their own professional development, not for their performance evaluation, their own data that they can either choose to share with their managers or not. It was critically important, I think, that the state decided to extend that all the way up through regional management, so that it wasn't just the supervisors going through this process, but kind of the mid-level and then the regional level managers were also involved in participating in the 360. And it was viewed more as an organizational development process, that the agency was investing in organizational development and the kind of aspects of supervision and or the skill sets that were evaluated in the process were, you know, everyone was using the same tool and getting the same type of feedback, although certainly appropriate to what they'd receive, but in the same sort of format, emphasizing the same roles of supervision, et cetera. I don't know, Susan or Peg, if you have anything to add, but I just wanted to mention those two things.
Crystal, that was very helpful. This is Susan, and my only observation is just as you were talking, it occurred to me that when I started thinking about child welfare training, so many years ago, the comment was made, how do you engage supervisors in their workers' training? How do you make sure that the supervisors understand what their workers are learning? How do you help supervisors make sure that they have the information and skills to do the transfer of learning with their workers? And now here's the question at the next level up. How do you have the supervisor's supervisor become engaged in the supervisor's training? And how do you have the supervisor's supervisor support transfer of learning? And so I would suspect that some of the same tools and tactics that we were talking about several years ago in terms of making sure that, you know, the old Dale Curry transfer of learning model, that before supervisors go to training, their supervisor, their manager talks with them about the value of training. And again, make sure that there is really time to go to training. One of the saddest survey results that I've ever heard that was not part of the survey, but some work I did recently, or a while ago, a worker told me that her supervisor never went to training as far as she knew. And of course, that wasn't true, but the supervisor had never shared with the worker that she herself took time to go for training. So there was a real gap in knowledge on the worker's part that the supervisor went for ongoing training, and sort of that opportunity to model the value of training had been lost. So I think we're looking at some vertical integration of some of the tools and tactics that we've used earlier to make sure that the supervisors are supporting their workers' learning. Are there other questions?
Thank you. I'm showing no further questions at this time.
Okay. I want to thank everyone for their active involvement and participation in this call. I think there's been some rich discussion, and I think this will be the first of several discussions on this topic. In fact, on Tuesday, June 16th, the Resource Centers will be supporting part two of this two-part series on supporting child welfare supervision. So I would encourage you, if you haven't already, to register for that call. Please do take the moment to fill out the evaluations. The folks at NRCOI review them all and take your feedback seriously, so it's important for us to hear from you via the evaluations. Remember, you can obtain audio files of this teleconference and others by going on the website, www.nrcoi.org, and you can, within a couple of days, be able to hear this teleconference again and share it with others in your organization that perhaps couldn't participate today. So let me thank all of you again, and most especially our panelists, Peg, Crystal, and Julie, for taking the time from your busy schedules to share with us your wisdom and information, and we appreciate it very much. With that said, I'll sign off and say thank you very much to everybody. Enjoy the remainder of your day.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. That concludes the conference. You may disconnect and have a wonderful day.